Welcome to the Real Estate Way to Wealth and Freedom podcast with Jacob Ayers, providing actionable content to help you along your journey to financial freedom through real estate investing. As the premier asset class, real estate has helped ordinary people just like you amass fortunes. The benefits of passive income from real estate investing will allow you to live a life you want. And now, your host, entrepreneur, real estate investor, and apartment deal syndicator, Jacob Ayers.
Hi, and welcome to the Real Estate Way to Wealth and Freedom podcast, episode 46. Today, we're going to be discussing commercial loans with our guest, Austin Peak. Austin is the principal at Riverstone Recap, where he manages the origination, underwriting, and placement of commercial real estate loans. Before starting Riverstone Recap, Austin was the assistant vice president at Capital Advisors for 2 years, where he was responsible for originating commercial real estate mortgages. Prior to Capital Advisors, he worked for Corinthian Real Estate, a Jacksonville-based mortgage brokerage firm. While there, he assisted the managing partner with sourcing equity and debt for real estate investors. Austin holds a Master of Science degree in real estate from Florida University. Today, welcome on the show, Austin Peak. Austin, thanks for joining us today. How are you?
Good, Jacob. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely, Austin. It's a pleasure. So, Austin, can you tell the audience a little bit about yourself and how you got started investing in real estate?
Yeah, so I'm actually on the commercial real estate end. My name's Austin Peak. I'm 31. I live in Jacksonville, Florida. And I started getting interested in real estate when I was back in college, let's say sophomore year. I remember it was summertime and I was going to University of Florida and I had a lot of free time. I think I cut that college point in time over the summer, even though I'm taking a class or two. I got bored. So I started going to Books a Million all the time, which was down the street. And I'd spend like 6 or 7 hours in there, like almost every day over the summer, and just read any real estate book that I could. Because I mean, I'm a college student, didn't have that much money. And I'm like, hey, I'll just bring a notepad, read a book, and just write ideas down. So that's kind of how I first got into real estate, really.
Yeah, awesome. And Austin, you're one of the few people that I've spoken with that actually has a degree in real estate. That is, you have a master's degree, right?
Yeah. So yeah, I went to University of Florida, graduated 2008, and that was with a degree in finance. And even at that point, I knew I wanted to do real estate. And at that point, when I graduated, at least Jacksonville, Florida is only about 2 hours away. I got moved back home. My parents, because I couldn't find a job. I mean, I tried to do anything to find a commercial real estate job, really. Over time, I just found out I like the commercial side more than the residential side because it's more number-based. It was less, if I don't want to work on the weekends and I want to talk to more business-oriented people, that's usually the way to get in is through more the commercial side. So I kept trying to find a job forever. Eventually, got a free job after 6 months of searching, really, and worked there for about a year and a half, 2 years, and then went back to University of Florida and got my master's in real estate.
Yeah, awesome.
Just if you don't mind, I'll give you a little bit more of the background just so people understand mine is that I used to work for, after I got my master's in real estate, and it was in 2011. I brought up my resume because I can't remember all this stuff. So
there we go.
Yeah. So then I worked for a bigger mortgage banking company. So they call it a commercial mortgage banking company for 2 years. Was making them a lot of money and not myself. So I figured I'd go ahead and start my own company. So I decided to go ahead and do that. And basically, I'm a commercial mortgage broker. What I do is help anyone who might own a shopping center, you know, multifamily, industrial center, whatever, anything from the $1 million range to $10 million range is my specialty. And I will just call on those owners to see if they have a new loan coming due. And when I do that, hopefully I can help them find a new loan. And I get paid when I actually get them a new mortgage. So only when the deal closes is when I get paid.
All right. So along with those clients of yours that already own properties, and you also take on new clients that are buying new properties, right?
Yeah. And I guess the original question was, again, what to look for in a mortgage broker?
Right. Yeah.
So I would say the main thing is, because I'm still, I guess, quote unquote, younger in the industry, is really you want to make sure that at least they've done some actual transactions. I would ask, have you done this type of transaction? Send me your last 5 transactions, something of that nature. And I would see if they're scared to even talk about the competitors, because I'm not. Because if it's me versus another guy, if the other guy's going to get the best deal at the end of the day, even if I'm not getting paid on it, I'd rather the owner get the best deal. Because personally, I see myself in that position within 10 years of being a commercial real estate owner and wanting to get the best deal possible, right? So I would say the main thing when you're looking at a broker is to go ahead and make sure that, you know, they have some experience, see some actual transactions, And then I would just do your homework and do some Googling, because unfortunately, there's a lot of people who are kind of like in the hard money space that are all basically kind of bullshitters. And I get that all the time, like hard money loans. And it's kind of hard to find out who are the real guys. So I would just do some Googling and look at LinkedIn or whatever and try to make sure that they're real.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, that's good advice. So you want to look for someone who's really done transactions and isn't afraid of their competitors or isn't afraid to send you towards a better deal if that's what it is.
Yeah. And like I said, I mean, there's some guys who always say that they're going to get you the best deal. But I mean, really, if I'm an owner based on my transaction, I would at least talk to two brokers. I would never just talk to one broker. But when you, if you're an owner and say you're going to three or four or five brokers, then a lot of those brokers go to the same lenders. So in the lender's point of view, if they're seeing the same deal from three or four different brokers, they're not really excited about this deal anymore. Because they're like, you know, how do I know they're not going to just go ahead and not get this loan closed and go with somebody else? So I would say get at least two brokers, but I wouldn't get more than three. So whenever those lenders actually see the deal, that they're excited about seeing the deal instead of seeing it from five different guys.
Yeah, good point. So Austin, how early should an investor be engaging with their mortgage broker in the deal? Should they, you know, get a deal under contract and then go to their mortgage broker, or should it be reverse? How best is that process?
Okay, so it depends on the relationship that you have with them. Okay, so just from my point of view, as a commercial mortgage broker, if I underwrite a deal, to say it's a multifamily deal or whatever, for an owner, if I don't mind doing the first couple, let's just say they're going to buy something, right? And they're not in the refinancing position. This is just an acquisition. If I'm going to go ahead and take my time and, you know, underwrite one deal, underwrite a second deal, underwrite a third deal, eventually I'm going to get tired of underwriting deals if I notice that they're really not a real owner, that they're just keep shopping to see if they can see what they can get. Because that really, I guess you can call it social capital to an extent, is that I only got so much time and so does the owner, right? So I'm getting deals from all different types of owners. And if I'm not getting real deals from owners, then eventually I'm like, hey, I'm sorry, I can't help you anymore. So again, that's kind of going back to that same broker thing that I was talking about, that I think is smart of any owner to have two brokers, but I probably want to do more than that. And sorry, what was your question again there too?
Yeah, I was asking how early an investor should be engaging with their mortgage broker.
Yeah, so I would say if you're buying, you should do it properly right when you actually have something signed to actually acquire the property. If you're refinancing though, I'd suggest 6 months to 9 months out. If you're getting within 3 months, you're really pushing it. Most deals at a minimum take 60 days to close. So I really advise probably that 6 month mark. If it's a loan maturity and it's coming due, you know it's coming due, then hey, I would go ahead and start calling around in brokers and see which one makes the most sense.
Yeah, and you make a good point, Austin, that, you know, you're underwriting deals for owners, essentially acting as a partner on their behalf. You're doing their due diligence for them, helping them take another look at the deal. And that's essentially what your process is when you're underwriting deals, right? Could you speak a little bit about what you're doing there?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just throwing in Excel, really. I mean, I could even take a blank, you know, worksheet and just do it right away. But basically, I could tell the owner, if I'm looking at it, if it's really, hey, you know, I think you're probably paying too much or paying too little. But really, at the end of the day, that's the owner's choice. I'm just telling them from the lender's point of view what I think they can get them. Because as a mortgage broker, my interest is in the owner. It's not the lender. And that's something that I kind of said in the beginning. There's mortgage bankers and mortgage brokers. So if you want to know the difference, mortgage bankers, a lot of them will service like life insurance companies actually lend them properties. Mm-hmm. And so if you go to a mortgage banker, which is where I was at before, well, most of the time that mortgage banker, their loyalty actually lies with the lender, because they're going to service those loans, which means every month that you're going to make a payment on your, you know, your debt payment, say of your apartment, it's actually going to that company, and they're actually going to take a small percentage of it because they're going to be quote unquote servicing the loan. So actually their loyalty lies with the lender. And that's there's a lot of secrets in like commercial real estate finance, and it's kind of shady and it's kind of sad, but that's one of the things, is that their interests aren't aligned with you. Versus as a mortgage broker, I don't represent any lender. So I represent only the owner. So,
yeah, that's a really important fact to understand, the difference between mortgage bankers and mortgage brokers. And you are a broker, which essentially means you're on the borrower's side.
Correct. Yes. And like I said, mortgage bankers, they'll say, hey, you know, I'm on both sides. I'm like, no, you really can't really be on both sides, can you? Like, how are you going to be in the middle and be on both sides? So they play, it's just like sitting on a seesaw. You know, you're like they're trying to do everything for the owner at first. But then once they get you under application, their loyalty lies with the lender. And so that's a really important thing to understand.
Right. Well, Austin, when you're underwriting deals, what kind of things are you looking at personally?
Really? So it depends on the type of deals. So I look at mostly what I've been working on lately is retail. So let's just say if it's a Walgreens, for instance, like there's a lot of senior citizen owners who might buy that instead of going to the stock market and investing in that. So they'll buy basically a triple net lease. And so if they're doing that on a Walgreens, for instance, what I'm always looking at for in a triple net pharmacy would be, hey, how many years are left on the lease term at refinancing? Second one is really looking at the location. So you want to actually look at how many pharmacies are in the area and if the demographics look pretty good. And the last one is really just trying to understand the sales, because it can be different looking at sales from Walgreens versus CVS versus Rite Aid. And there's a calculation you got to use on all those. So really, if we're looking at those kind of commercial properties, we're looking at lease term, rent, and just any kind of vacancy factors. So those are main things when we're looking at commercial real estate.
Yeah, so there's some similarities there with commercial multifamily. Obviously, location's important in all real estate, lease terms.
Yeah, and vacancy. I mean, it's really, that's the thing. So as being a mortgage broker, I can actually land all across the country, because really it only takes, 30 minutes to figure out a market, but it's really, no matter the property type, it's really the same thing. I mean, you're just looking at a vacancy or rent and just getting a feel for the area and seeing, what makes sense. So those are the main factors when you're looking at any property to buy.
Yeah, awesome. And now how about multifamily property specifically? I know you mentioned, let's back up. You mentioned triple net leases. Can you talk about what a triple net lease is?
Yeah, so that's the best way to think about it is that Walgreens, that same Walgreens example, the owner actually owns the building. Walgreens is owning the building, right? And then so they are paying the owner the actual rent payment every year. Well, they're also, what Walgreens is, they're taking care of their own common area maintenance, that's what that stands for, their real estate taxes, and their insurance. So that's what a net is. So one net is insurance, one net is CAM, and one net is taxes. So normally, if it was an office building, for example, most of the tenants in an office building, let's just say it's a single tenant office building, well, usually the owner who owns that building has to take care of all that stuff. They have to take care of real estate taxes, insurance, and common area maintenance. And so that would be a no net lease. So the differences there are, so if it's just a triple net lease, it's much less for the owner to worry about, because the actual company, or in this particular example, Walgreens, they're the one taking care of everything, and they just send a written check to the owner.
Right. Okay. Now, Austin, let's switch gears a little bit and start talking about loan products that real estate investors have at their disposal for buying small multifamily properties. Can you talk about different loan products out there?
I guess when you say small, what do you mean?
Let's say 10 to 100 units.
Mm-hmm. So again, most of the stuff that I deal with, I mean, I can go down to 500K, but usually it's about a million, the lowest loan amount that I go on. And really the best lenders for that are what they call agency lenders, which is our Fannie or Freddie. In multifamily, those almost always win because they have the best interest rates, because our government subsidizes the interest rates. So the owner gets the best, basically, terms on a loan there. So it's hard for banks or life insurance companies or CMBS lenders to compete with the agency lenders, which again, the agency lenders are Fannie, Freddie, and those are the two main ones on the smaller ones.
Right. Okay. And what do certain loan products look like for Fannie and Freddie? I know that those types of lenders have what we call non-recourse loans. Could you talk about those?
Yeah. So the ability about doing non-recourse loan is that, say if we're going to go get a $1 million loan on an apartment building, one being recourse, one being non-recourse. So on the non-recourse loan, let's say you bought the property with $300,000, right? So it's a 70% loan. We're getting a $700,000 loan.
Right.
Right. So again, it was $1 million valuation altogether. So if something happened and just say everyone left that apartment building, well, on a non-recourse loan, basically it stinks because you put 300K into buying the building and maybe everyone was in there, but then everyone left and you got no more rent. And you, let's say it's day one of trying to pay your mortgage. Well, on a non-recourse loan, that 700K in debt, the lender can't come after you, but you will lose the 300K that you ended up putting in. Now, if it's a recourse loan, they could actually come after you for everything. So they'd come after you for the 700 as well. So because you're not signing recourse against that loan, the lender's making that loan because they think it's a good loan. And so usually you're paying a slightly higher interest rate, but that's really the difference between recourse and non-recourse, is that they have the ability to come after you if you have recourse. And if it's non-recourse, they don't have that ability.
Right. So in a non-recourse loan, you're not personally liable for the note.
Correct. And so, there are some little details on it where they call them like standard carve-outs of a non-recourse loan. So as long as you don't do any like fraud or anything of that nature where in regular contracts you could get sued, then they won't come after you.
Right. Okay. Now, can you talk a little bit about lending from a syndication perspective, when people are pooling funds to buy an apartment building, and what kind of loan products are out there for that type of scenario?
Yeah, that's much more difficult once you start getting into syndications. And I want to feel like comfortable enough giving advice either way on it. I mean, usually the owners that I work with, for example, they're going to buy apartment. Let's still use the same example. They're going to buy an apartment building and they buy it with an LLC. Usually it's like one guy owns 100% of that LLC. Well, sometimes they have partners, which is fine. And then maybe it's two guys who are buying it. So 50-50 partners. So basically, I would need financials, personal financials on both those guys who are going to buy the building so we can underwrite and make sure that they haven't had any bankruptcies or fraud in the past. But once you start getting a syndication, you get that many, the more and more people who get involved, the more difficult it becomes. And so for me personally, I don't work on syndications just because for me, they're way more difficult to get closed. And I only have so much time just like everybody else. So if it's that much harder to get closed and I'm going to get paid the same, I'm just going to go with the numbers and try to get done with the easiest loans that I can.
Right, right. Okay. Lawson, can you talk a little bit about what benefits Fannie and Freddie have out there over the other loan products?
Well, they can do the 30-year amortization schedule. Most lenders only do 25-year amortization schedule. And then they have certain terms that basically they give a higher LTV than most of the regular lenders too. So I would say those are the main things is that if I'm looking at multifamily, you always want to go to a Fannie or Freddie lender. And so there's a few of them around the country. And actually, I put together a list that I can give you a hyperlink if you want to put in the show notes to see which ones actually are those. But basically, there's certain lenders that represent Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. And you just go to one of those guys. They all get the same quotes, basically, because, again, it's coming from the government.
Right.
The government's basically underwriting it. So if I'm ever going multifamily, you need to make sure you at least look into Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, because personally, I can't compete with them if I'm doing a multifamily loan, because I would say, hey, go directly to this agency lender, then you don't have to pay me, and these guys are going to give you the best quote. So
yeah, right. Okay. Now, oftentimes with Fannie and Freddie Macs, there are interest-only periods. Is that correct?
Yeah. So it depends on it. So those are one of the things that you can also do. Really, the bigger the loan, the more flexibility you have to get things like that, you know, whether it be interest only or there are some underwriting parameters. But the main thing is that they can lock it in. They can lock in that interest rate for 10 years on a 30-year amortization, where most commercial buildings would be 25-year amortization schedules. Or like I said, any life company or CMBS lender, if they want to loan on multifamily, they're looking at either higher interest rate or a lower amortization schedule.
All right. And what are some of the lending requirements for these Fannie, Freddie type loans in terms of reserves, liquidity, experience, things like that?
Yeah. So there's the 90 for 90, which they 90 days. They have to have 90% occupancy. And I've actually got a list here that too, I think it'd be maybe just easier if I give those and add those to the show notes too, so people can see the actual differences, if that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I mean, it's an easy checklist. It's mainly, they just have certain check boxes that they need to make sure that, hey, you know, that this property has had 90% occupancy for 90 days or X, Y, and Z. So there's a few checklist items. And again, my specialty more on the commercial side. So it's just easier, I think, if I give everyone a checklist on it than doing it from memory.
Yeah, sure. That'd be great. Yeah, we'll link those in the show notes for our listeners to check out.
Yeah.
All right, Austin, what other things should a real estate investor be looking at when they're looking for commercial loans for their smaller apartment buildings?
Let's see.
We've covered a few things now. We've talked about non-recourse loans, interest-only payments, the difference in Fannie and Freddie. We've talked about who to look to in terms of bankers versus brokers. So anything else you can think of that our investors should be aware of when going out and shopping for loans?
I mean, really, I feel like I've covered it all. Unless, do you have any questions specifically? And then I could tell you. I'm just trying to think off the top of my head. I guess doing it long enough that I forget.
Yeah, no, that's okay. Let's kind of drill down on that interest-only terms, because oftentimes you hear people who get loan terms that there might be 1 to 3 years of interest-only payments before the principal and payments kick in. Could you talk about what that arrangement looks like, how common that loan product is?
Yeah, again, it's a smaller one. It's less likely. I mean, here, when I ask a lender or ask an owner, I always ask him, hey, what's most important to you? A, the loan amount, right? B, the interest rate, or C, if it's recourse versus non-recourse. And then I'll ask him about, you know, amortization. And then what does the owner usually say? Hey, I want the best interest rate. I want the highest loan amount. I want non-recourse. And I'm like, not necessarily. I need a priority, right? So I think it's important
right.
for an owner to write out their priorities in it, right? So what are you really most interested in? So if it's really the smallest debt, monthly debt payment, okay, that makes sense. If it's really the highest loan amount, like say if I got that Yale loan, that was $100K difference from another one, but the interest rate was slightly better. So it's just important that the owner try to figure that out. And what I would personally do and what I do for my clients to put together a quote called a quote matrix where, hey, you know, I'll put 1, 2, 3, this is lender 1, 2, 3. These are their terms compared to these other terms. And so that usually, I guess, answers all the questions that an owner will have, because I'll just put it, I make it easy for them. Hey, it's in a spreadsheet here. You decide. I'm not here to make the decision for you. It's whatever you think. Because personally, every owner looks at a deal differently. So it's hard for me to say which one's going to be best for them.
Right. That's a really good point.
Because I'll say it's like some of them, a recourse loan is, they rather have a recourse loan because they have more flexibility. So one thing we didn't talk about is like prepayment terms. So if you're getting a non-recourse loan, then almost always they have prepayment terms where you cannot prepay the loan until, say, for example, if it's a 10-year loan term, usually you cannot pay that loan back within, say, 9 years and 9 months. Usually you only have the last 3 years open. Well, there are so many different prepayment terms, whether it's called defeasance, which is with CMBS loans, or if we're talking about with life insurance companies, they look at something called yield maintenance. And then there's also something called step down prepayment. So where if it's a 10-year loan term, maybe the first 2 years that if you wanted to pay that loan back in full, it'd be a 5% penalty, which is not worth it for the owner. And then next 2 years, it might be 4%. Next 2 years, 3%. Next 2 years, 2%. So those are the different types of things that when I put in a loan matrix for the owner, I'm like, hey, you know, you decide what's most important to you. These are what I can get from you. I think I can get some flexibility on a couple of these things, but I'm not going to keep going back to the lender saying, hey, you know, tighten up your interest rate for me or give me a higher loan amount over and over, because I can't burn that bridge with that lender at the same point in time. So it's important, again, to just understand what you want as an owner.
Yeah, right. All really good points. That prepayment penalty is something the borrower should be aware of, because like you said, if there are prepayment terms, then the borrower could be in a position where they have to pay a steep penalty if they pay off the loan early. That's essentially what that means, right?
Exactly. So yeah, so that's the caveat to non-recourse. So if you have a recourse loan, usually there is no prepayment penalty, because so you can pay it back whenever you want, kind of like a home loan, for example. So that, you know, when I ask about prepayment terms to an owner, they always say, you know, I don't want to play prepayment either, and I want non-recourse. I'm like, well, shit, you don't get everything. You can't, because the only reason they can do non-recourse is because they have these prepayment terms, because basically they're just selling your loan off to a bigger institution and they're packaging them all together. And so they can't do that without having a fixed steady income coming in from your debt payment. And your debt payment is that security. So that's the reason they have those prepayment terms in there.
Right. Now, Austin, we haven't really nailed down on interest rates, but what kind of interest rate ranges can an investor expect in these types of loan products? I know it's a fairly hard answer to give a specific answer to, but could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I can give you this link too. So I'm trying to look, because I don't look at interest rates every day, because everyone would be like, hey, you know, what can I get today? You know,
and right.
I'm like, it really just depends. So every lender, when they look at a property, they all look at it slightly different. So some want to have, if we're just talking about multifamily, for example, some lenders are okay with going C-class properties, right? But some only want A-class properties. So those A-class properties, if that's a lender who only wants to do A-class multifamily, then their interest rate's going to be lower than a C-class multifamily. So, and there's certain lenders that only want to lend in, you know, certain markets. Say they consider Jacksonville probably a secondary market versus Atlanta being a primary market. And then the tertiary market's anything probably under like 100,000 people or 50,000. It just depends wherever you are across the country and looking at demographics. So if they're still willing to do a loan and they're looking at their risk, they're just going to raise their interest rate a little bit more on that product. So again, I would say if we're just looking multifamily, because that's what it sounds like most of your investors are looking for, then the Fannie Freddie Mac loans, those generally are going to have a fixed spread on it. So they're usually looking at it doing over a 10-year U.S. Treasury. And right now they're on the low 4% for a 10-year, 30-year term.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah, that's essentially what we'd like to know is, you know, what kind of ballpark is it? 4, 6, 10, 12, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So low 4% is usually what it is. Right now, at least today. I mean, it has been over the last few months and probably the next few months forward. So really, the rates haven't changed too much over the last 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, right. That brings up a good point, Austin, is the Federal Reserve has kept rates at almost all-time lows for several years now, and there's a little bit of inclination that they're going to raise, and they have raised a couple times so far. Could you talk about what the future of mortgage real estate investing, or sorry, could you talk about what the future of commercial loans look like in your perspective?
I keep saying you only think the rates can go higher, but they've kind of kept them lower because if they end up raising it, then the U.S. economy, they have to pay back their debt, right? So they're that's why they're keeping them so low. So it's hard for me to like predict. I try not to because that's something it's kind of out of, it is out of my control, right? I always just say it's in comparison to what? So the rates today, even if they went up 1% or 2%, 3%, I mean, compared to in the 80s when they're at 12, 13, 14%, that's a fantastic deal still, right? So, and I would say also that the rates, like the values that someone pays for a multifamily property or any commercial property, they buy with a cap rate. Do you understand that?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. So that cap rate is a function of the interest rate. So if the interest rate goes up, cap rates go up. So at the end of the day, those owners are going to be paying more or less for the property than they were before. So it's all a game. I mean, really, it's hard to say if they go up or down, but it's always going to be shown in the valuation of the actual property because that cap rate is always a function of the interest rate. Because if people want to buy commercial properties, like 90%+ of them have commercial mortgages on them.
Yeah, right. And that's one thing to point out, Austin, that you make a good point on is if interest rates go up, cap rates go up because they're tied together. Say if you have an 8% cap rate and you borrow money at 5%, you have a 3% spread and that's where you make your money at. So
right. And so again, if it goes up to 6%, then usually that person's going to be buying at 9% if it's that same spread, right? So that's really all it is. And an interest rate from a lender, all it is, they're taking a U.S. Treasury or they're taking a 10-year swap rate if it's a 10-year term, and they're just putting in their spread over it. So if they think the loan's going to be more risky, they're just going to increase their basis. It's just, it's about 200 points right now, 200 to 250, depends on the lender. It's just all coming down to the interest rates at the end of the day, but it'll be shown in valuations over time.
Right. All right, Austin. Well, that's all great stuff. You've certainly given our listeners some things to look towards and when they're looking for real estate loans. Now, as we're wrapping up here, we've got a lightning round and just a series of questions we'd like to ask you if you're ready for those.
Let's do it.
All right. Well, these are typically tailored towards real estate investors, so we'll kind of tweak them for yourself. So our first question is, do you have a personal habit that contributes to your success?
Well, I do work under pressure. I mean, I used to always just get up early without even the alarm ringing. I mean, this is how crazy it was because I really did like real estate that much when I was working for the bigger company. I mean, I'd wake up at 4:30 a.m. and get to the office early every single day, and I didn't touch on this, but part of the reason I got interested in that commercial real estate is because I went and actually shadowed lots of commercial real estate owners or investors or brokers. And I wanted to make sure that I wanted to do it. And so what I did is I tried to figure out the brokers that I actually shadowed. Basically I just said, hey, can I follow you around for 3 or 6 hours for this day to try to get understand what you do? And when you're a college student, especially, or a younger person, they almost always want to help you. And so I saw what the actual smart people did and who are making money. A lot of them just woke up early and basically had a strategy. So I try to have a strategy and really just try to work hard. And now I stopped working as hard, but I try to work a little bit smart now.
Well, good. All right, Austin, do you have an online resource that you find valuable?
You know, say I can send you one of these web links that I use when I always go to look at these the rates. It's called, thefinancials.com. So if your owners are really just interested in looking at interest rates, I just come there and I'll look at 10-year swap or 10-year interest rate. So thefinancials.com if you're interested in commercial real estate.
Sure, absolutely. All right, Austin, what book would you recommend to the listeners and why?
I got two. And I don't read too much anymore. Not just YouTube or Google everything. So the first one was called The Real Estate Game. Have you heard of that?
I have not.
Okay. It's by William Porview. He's a Harvard Business School real estate teacher. I've read this book probably 10 times and over the last 10 years. And it's basically, he just takes you deal by deal, different types of deals, and tells you how he looks at it from an owner's perspective. And I think that was really cool because it's not like you're reading a textbook just learning about commercial real estate or residential real estate. It's through stories. And looking at these stories, he goes you through a story. Hey, how owner A looks at this deal in New York with his warehouse deal or whatever. So that's the one I really recommend the most. And then the other one, if you're getting a brokerage business, even though I'm on the commercial side, it was Your First Year in Real Estate called by Dirk Zeller. I mean, and they basically just had good ideas on basically if you're going to be a broker, how to come up with a strategy. Because just saying, hey, I'm going to be a broker and make money. Well, you better put a plan together. I mean, there's so many guys when I was doing the commercial mortgage brokerage, they just kind of run around with chickens, like with their heads cut off. I mean, they're just like, hey, call on wheeling, dealing. But right. you got to find out like what those people really want. If you're going to really make money, you got to come up with a game plan. So
yeah, going that's back why to like, having that strategy, right?
Yeah, that's what made me successful when I was doing it at the other companies. Like, okay, there could have been like, hey, Austin, go call every commercial real estate owner in Jacksonville. Well, if I'm calling every owner, then at least that's something, I guess. But I came up with a strategy to find owners that had maturing mortgages because I know that they had to get commercial real estate loans done. And so if they got commercial real estate loans done, because the loan's coming due. So A, they're either going to have to sell it right, or B, they're going to have to refinance it. So if I'm going to help them refinance it, then my percentages go higher. And so I'm going to call on those guys and try to get deals done.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. All right, Austin, if you were to give advice to your 20-year-old self to get started in real estate, what would it be?
I touched on this earlier, and this is what like so many people don't do, and it's silly, especially if you're still in college, is that if you can shadow so many people and they're going to say yes because you're a college student. And even if you're not into real estate or in anything, it's like, hey, put a list together of people that you, hey, I might want to do this. And especially over the summers, like when in college, it's like, hey, when I had the opportunity to ask those real life questions other than just reading all the time, that was super helpful, because then I got to said, hey, do I want to get in the appraisal side? Do I want to do residential versus commercial? Do I want to do development? You know, what do I want to do? So I would say, hey, do what you did and good job shadowing those people. And actually, you're kind of doing the same thing right here, which I think is really smart. So if you're talking to, you know, real estate owners or people in any real estate, you're learning just from talking to them like right now. It's like just networking and they're happy to talk to you about it. So you're getting that knowledge and you're building your network. So just doing that is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime. Well, one, in this business, it's a lot of our passion. So you like to talk about it with your peers, network with people. And anytime you're talking real estate with somebody, it's like you're learning your business. You're working on your business, and essentially. So yeah, it's an easy way to gain knowledge and, you know, just learn.
Yeah. And people like talking about themselves, and they like them, said, just learning and networking from them. It's silly not to do, honestly. So, I mean, I really, over the last couple of years, I got too involved in my business and not kind of looking outside of just real estate or people in general. And so I got tired of going to those little network mixers, right? Like those local realtor ones, if you're thinking about residential, or they have different associations.
Right.
That, hey, let's go to this mixer. But I mean, are you really gaining anything if it's the same people doing everything? But I think when you have more of those one-on-one conversations and get to dive deep into their business, I think it's much more valuable.
Right. Well, Austin, as we're wrapping up here, that actually brings up a good lead into your upcoming podcast called Millionaire Interviews. Could you talk a little bit about that and also let us know where our audience can reach out and find more about you?
Yeah, no, for sure. And I appreciate you bringing it up. And I do have, I guess, the last gift is that on millionaire-interviews.com. And if you want to put it in show notes as well, I put dash the real estate way with dashes in between. It's, I got a list of like 270 lenders that I'm just giving away. Cause I mean, if you just sign up, put in your email, then you get it mailed to you. But it's something I put together with all the different life companies or CMBS lenders or agency lenders. And you can see the names of all these different types of lenders. And I put parameters on what's their minimum loan amount, generally what's their largest loan amount, whatever. So if you just go there, you get email a list of 265 lenders that did in the Excel list.
And then, awesome. Well, we certainly appreciate that.
Yeah, no, for sure. And then about the podcast. Yeah. So me, I've gotten so involved in commercial real estate and I enjoyed it. And I still, you know, do originate commercial real estate loans, but I've started transitioning a little bit more to just podcasting in general and really talking to, well, as the title says, millionaires. So instead of just sticking to the real estate industry, I actually talk to people in all different types of industry. And that's actually what motivated me to start my own company is that, hey, when I was working for a bigger company, when I was doing yard work on the side or, you know, during the weekends, I'd listen to podcasts all the time. And so anyone listening to this podcast, you're already, you know, ahead of 99% of people, right?
Oh,
so
absolutely.
As far as learning, so you're obviously a smart person if you're listening. But I would listen to podcasts like these that weren't in the real estate industry. I actually was able to learn a lot about organizing your company, about hiring virtual assistants, about really anything. It just give you that confidence that you could do it. So I've decided that, hey, why don't I go ahead and just start my own podcast? I'll go ahead and interview people who aren't just in the, like you said, real estate industry. It's mostly actually other industries, although I've had a few real estate investors on, but really it's there just to inspire A and B, just kind of for those people to tell their stories, those entrepreneurs who have been successful, what the actual things they've done to go ahead and start their companies. It's not like I hate doing it when they're 10,000 miles up looking down, just saying, oh, I did this in general. No, give me actual details, right? So that's what there's a few podcasts like that when I was back in the day when I would decide to start my own Riverstone Recap, but I've kind of faded away and I'm like, hey, I want to bring that up back up. And I thought this would be a good platform to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Austin, listening to a podcast is one of the easiest ways to shadow someone. So
exactly. Like I said, how much do you learn in I would say, I mean, it's so easy. I'm sure you get their contact information. Just send an email to whoever, Jacob, after you interview. Just say, thanks for doing the podcast. And oh my gosh, like that person's just going to say, you know, send an email back to you. How hard is that? And really, you gain a contact as well. What, Jacob doing all the hard work and scheduling it all, right? So
right.
That's what I mean, that is just one other step that is so easy other than just listening. And, you know, you don't need to do it to every guest that you have on, but, you know, especially the ones that, you know, resonate with you, just say thanks to them or anything. And then you make a connection right there.
Yeah, that's very true. Mm-hmm. All right, Austin, well, wrapping up, where can our audience find more about you?
Yeah, I'd say, yeah, if you go to millionaire-interviews.com, that's probably the best place to reach me now. And then, if we're interested in commercial real estate loans, I can give you that contact information as well. It's riverstonerecap.com.
All right, Austin. Well, we certainly appreciate your time on the show today, and we'll link your contact information in the show notes for our audience to get a hold of you if they have any other questions.
All right. Thank you, Jacob.
All right. Thank you, Austin. Take care. All right, that wraps up our interview today with Austin Peak. As you can tell, Austin has a ton of great information around sourcing and what to look for in your next commercial loan for your investment property. If you have any questions about anything mentioned on the show today, feel free to reach out to either myself or Austin, and we'd be glad to help you out however we can. As always, if you have any questions or comments, or want to hear something or someone specific on the show, let me know. You can contact me at www.jacobayers.com/contact, or connect with me on Facebook at The Real Estate Way to Wealth and Freedom. Till next week, signing off, I'm your host, Jacob Ayers.
You've been listening to the Real Estate Way to Wealth and Freedom podcast, providing you actionable content to build your real estate empire. Nothing on this show should be considered specific, personal, or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, financial, or business professional for personal advice. The opinions of guests are their own. Information is not guaranteed. All investment strategies have a potential for profit or loss. The host is operating on behalf of the Real Estate Way to Wealth and Freedom, LLC, exclusively.